This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Was ist noch besser als ein guter Plan? Die Möglichkeit, ihn zu ändern. Mit integrierter KI bietet Workday kontinuierliche Innovationen, die Ihnen helfen, agil zu bleiben, egal was passiert. Workday, the finance and HR system for a changing world.
Foul, Schwalbe, rote Karte, Videobeweis, Fußballdiskussionen, da hilft die Big Man-Methode. Ja, die Big Man-Methode. Schlichtet schnell, einfach und effektiv jede Debatte. Denn nur beim Big Mac sind sich alle einig. Probieren Sie die Big Man-Methode. Nur bei McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Hello, it's Holly Hamilton here once again for Stephen This Week. And today we have been talking about this rise in racially motivated hate crime in Antrim Town over the past few weeks. The latest Nazi symbols and references to neo-Nazi group Combat 18 have been sprayed across buildings in the town as well as at a new housing development. It was described by one business owner as a tsunami of racism. Who is doing it? What can be done by police to crack down on it or by local residents? What are politicians doing? We were also chatting about bonfires, as we tend to do this time of year. In particular, there's one in East Belfast at the site of a newly refurbished park, which cost £1.7 million to fix up. So we were asking if that was the right place to put a bonfire and what are the optics of that? And today is, well, the first day of school, I suppose, at Westminster. The new MPs are getting sworn in today. So we were looking at what it's like on that first day when you walk in as a brand new MP. What are the rules? How do you find your way about? Particularly when it's such a large intake of new MPs this time. We spoke to former MP Lemba Oakbrook as well. Thank you so much for all your comments on all of our topics today. In the meantime, get in touch, nolan@bbc.co.uk. And we are back on Wednesday morning at 9 o'clock. See you then.
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Hello, good morning, and it is a Tuesday morning with Holly Hamilton here today, just listening to the weather. I know I talk about the weather a lot, maybe it's because I do get the weather just before I open my mouth, but oh, what a tease it was yesterday. I actually ate my dinner in the garden last night. That is the first time I've done that this year. I put out garden furniture, and now look, it's dreak. It's Drake. Anyway, we'll try to distract you from all that. We do have a very busy show, as always. It is the first few days in the job at Westminster today. As you've been hearing, pretty much sort of freshers week, first day of school vibes, MPs being sworn in. I just wonder what those first few days are like. We'll be talking about that and also discussing voter turnout across the UK and here in Northern Ireland. I'd really like to hear from you on that one, particularly if you didn't vote. I want to know if that was a decision that you made not to vote. Or maybe it was just the timing, you were away on holiday, you forgot, or maybe you just don't care. Whatever it is, I'd love to hear from you. 03030 80 55 55. I'd also like your reaction to our first topic this morning. You might have seen this in the papers today and certainly online yesterday. Racist graffiti has been sprayed at multiple sites in Antrim. And this, of course, just a week after we were talking about eight families being intimidated out of their homes in the town. Now, swastikas and symbols relating to neo-Nazi group Combat 18 have also been painted on across the walls. And this wave of graffiti follows several reports of racism and sectarian attacks in the area in recent weeks. Now, Miriam, not her real name, moved to Northern Ireland 20 months ago. And she told our reporter, Eita Duncan, that she moved out of her home following this intimidation.
Does it mean that we are going to die just because we're on work visa?
Do you feel like you could die?
Exactly. If nothing has been done, we were going to die because in this place, we don't know how they are going to escalate from what they've done. And they are continuing to write some posters and to put more threats on us. So you can just die in this place. Maybe they will take action when someone is dead. Because of the CCTV, I got notification on my phone that someone is on the car. So I immediately got up and looked at the car to see what did that person do, because I thought maybe he came with a bomb. He put a bomb in the car. So when I went out, that's when I saw that the windows are broken. We called police. Police was here. They tried to reassure us, but I was so devastated, you know. I felt helpless. I felt as if I'm a prisoner. Even when we were looking up for accommodation, when we came here, no one told us that this is a no-go area, because this place is a place that has been known for years that foreigners are not welcome in this place. But no one told us, only to see it when things are happening to us.
It's hard to hear her say things like, I felt like I could die. There's been a huge reaction to this. Newly elected MP Robin Swan gave us this reaction to the graffiti.
And we've asked now for a meeting with the PSNI so we can get in to discuss the actual facts behind it. But the sectarian nature and the racist nature of the paintings and the graffiti that has been in there this morning, you know, Combat 18 swastika is painted on any house in Northern Ireland is an insult to democracy.
Now, David Edmund is managing director, one of the managing directors of the Bridge Association. That's a not-for-profit training organisation that runs an ability cafe, which is staffed by people with learning difficulties. And Monday was the first day of trading. But the night before, the back of their shop was sprayed with Nazi symbols. And David joins me now. Good morning, David.
Morning, Holly.
First of all, just tell me your reaction when you saw those symbols painted on your store.
We arrived early yesterday, as I say, our new ability cafe was due to open, and we arrived early to get our last bits and pieces all tidied up and making sure our new shop was looking good for everyone to come in. And we were shocked and horrified when we seen on the front and the main entrance to the mall in Antrim that there was the signs were on the walls. We went in and said, look, this is not a good place to be, but we're fully aware of the situation from last week and tensions have been rising. We then went into our other social enterprise that we have within the mall and we walked out the back, and literally on the back doors, the swastikas were there, the NF signs and the C18 signs were there. Our adults have learning disabilities and they do not understand the tension that goes on. They are there to do a work and receive training from ourselves to improve their lives. Only when they were asking us and our staff what these signs meant, we had to tell them, look, these are bad men that are doing this and it's nothing to do with them and things like this. And that they were talking about war films and things like this where they'd seen these signs before.
I mean, a cafe that's run by people with learning difficulties, why do you think that would have been targeted?
I'm not suggesting it was primarily us, Holly. It was the whole way round the mall. We actually walked around the perimeter and seen other signs around other shops, but it was ironic that ours was sort of smack bang in the middle and ours was the one that seemed to be targeted either side of our back doors where we're receiving deliveries and things like this from on a daily basis. So it was quite shocking for us and disturbing. And I have to say, our trainees don't fully understand the situation. They're there as best as we can to make them enjoy their day and give them a full day. And we're faced with that, and we had to have that conversation with them. And with other trainees now going up today, and with absolutely no doubt whatsoever, we'll have the same situation because the signs are still there. They haven't been cleaned off properly. The mall staff did do the best they could, but unfortunately, the signs are still there this morning. So.
And obviously, as you mentioned, this is something that you have been aware of, certainly in recent weeks. What is that like? What does that feel like?
The situation in Antrim has been tremendous. We're as an organisation, we're here 34 years, and through the dark days of the past, and we've now came through in the situation where everyone, community relations within the town, well, we believe we're at an all-time high. And all of a sudden, because of the new housing going up and proposed new developments, we're left with a situation that people are becoming all of a sudden territorial. I have no doubt that if it is young people that are doing this, they don't fully understand this is what they're being led, the path they're being led to by older members of the community, I would suggest. Because we've been there ourselves. We all know the connotations of things like that. Unfortunately, there's just mindless people just decided that they're clearly marking, I believe, the territories for themselves, which is something that none of us in this day and age can tolerate.
You know, it's interesting you talk about being territorial and young people. It's almost quite sad to think that. You wonder where they're getting this from.
I believe that there's older elements within the town centre who are fully aware of this. Young people nowadays, even our young staff, had they asked us, we've employed 3 19-year-olds in their first ever jobs, giving them an opportunity and a purpose in life to help and assist our trainees. 3 19-year-olds asking us what the signs meant. Mm-hmm. So others know exactly what they're doing, know the connotations. I mean, how do they explain to them what that was? If our trainees and our young adults with learning disability were asking what these signs meant, we had to explain to our staff first what they meant.
What do you think they're trying to achieve? And I'm just thinking in terms of the reaction that we have had. People have left the area. Is that what they want?
I think so. I think there's a clear pathway where they're saying there's new homes being built. Depending on what side of the community they're falling on, they're deemed to be houses for that side of the community. And in this day and age, it's absolutely ridiculous that people cannot be afforded to live. The Casa Mall owners built some of those houses and handed them over to Choice Housing at that time. And that's when it started. So I can only imagine that it wasn't only ourselves that were being targeted, it was the owners of Casa Mall as well, who built the houses and handed them over then to Choice Housing.
It is sad that we have become accustomed here to hearing about sectarian abuse, but when it comes to racism and people being intimidated due to the colour of their skin, you do wonder where this is coming from.
Absolutely, and it's a sad indictment of the society we now live in, especially here in Antrim, where things have been relatively positive and people were actively working together throughout the whole community, and ourselves being totally non-sectarian whatsoever in the organisation we're running, that we find a situation where people are now saying, oh, you know what, I think the only way to put it, you either have to be a white Protestant or a black or not anything else. And that seems to be a sad indictment of some mindless people within the community here in Antrim.
Speaking as someone who's a resident in the town, do you feel intimidated?
I don't live in the town. I work in the town. And ironically, turning the clock back, I was the former chairman of the Peace One programme. I was in Antrim town, and I was honoured to be the chairman of that during Peace One and Peace Two at the time. Mm-hmm. And we're delighted the progress that was made, and we've seen the changes, and we implemented everything we possibly could to develop the whole community at that time. And it's a sad indictment now that we'll find ourselves turning the clock back 30-odd years later.
Just to summarise, and it's why we're talking about it this morning, just how bad has it got? How much are people in the town talking about this?
It is the talk of the town. Even customers coming into the cafe yesterday, first of all, asked us how we felt this morning and things like that. They'd already seen some of the information coming out. They asked about our trainees, were they okay? And the general public coming in under our new cafe have been very, very supportive, and I've no doubt that will continue given the work that we do within the town. However, there is, again, great discussion in every outlet, even within Casa Mall. The owners are working tirelessly to assure everyone that we're, as best as they can, everyone's safe while they're in it. It's a safe environment to work in. and all that good stuff. But however, the underlying threat, if it's not sort of sorted quickly, it's just going to spiral out of all control, we believe.
I read you described it as a tsunami of racism. Do you feel that enough has been done to prevent this tsunami?
No, absolutely. There's community leaders out there who have an automatic insight into the people that they have and they represent. There's new elected councillors from last year who we're working closely with, and it's the onus would be on them to come down, sit with those communities, we believe, sit with those community leaders, and indeed the newly elected MP, as we heard earlier on. Everyone has a role to play in this, but it starts at community level. There are community activists out there who can have a word, who can speak to the people they need to speak to. I'm sure they all know who they are, because Antrim's is relatively small town where they can get this job done and get it quelled and get it back to where it was a few months ago, where people could walk freely around the town, free from intimidation and free from any form of sectarianism or indeed racism.
When you say get back to that, it feels like you feel that Antrim Town is so far removed from that now that you cannot walk down the street without feeling intimidated.
I have no fear whatsoever of walking through Antrim Town. None of us should have. However, when we'll have black and Asian people walking through the town, they have to be able to share the same space that everyone else within Antrim Town enjoys. And that was being seen to be done. We've seen an increase of people coming through, which has been great for Antrim Town and good for Antrim Town. However, all of a sudden now with the new houses going up, people are clearly then seen to be in, well, those houses are earmarked for us, and that's the way it is, and that's the sad fact and the sad reality of it, we believe.
Yeah, again, I read somewhere that there was this sense coming from social media about looking after our own, whatever that means.
Looking after our own is absolutely right. And I think that's the sad fact. That's local people doing that. And so those community leaders, someone is telling people to go out and do this. And the people that are doing it probably don't even know what they're doing or why they're doing it. They're just being told to do that. So the people who are sending them out need to have a look at themselves and say, you know what, maybe this is the wrong approach. There's easier ways to do it. There's enough money being thrown about and branded about to assist all the community groups within the area. Lord knows that with European money maybe drying up, they wonder where the next pot of gold's coming from. Who knows? We really don't know. But it's senseless that people in this day and age would take the approach to say, you know, that we have to clearly mark our lines out. Those days are long, long gone and should remain that way.
The Nazi symbols that have been outside your shop, how are they removed? Does someone have to go out, scrub them off? What happens?
The owners, Casamal, attempted to do that yesterday. Unfortunately, they're still quite clearly visible this morning. And we'll probably have to live with that until such times as they're removed. But just hope that when they are, people have the good sense and decency to make sure that they remain that way and when they are cleaned up.
David, thank you very much for talking to us and sharing your story. I want to speak now to Patrick Corrigan, the Northern Ireland Director of Amnesty International. Good morning, Patrick.
Morning, Holly.
It is almost disturbing to think that someone will be visiting Antrim Town and for perhaps days or weeks see a clearly painted or faded swastika on the side of quite a few walls by the sounds of things.
Yes, obviously it's deeply disturbing for visitors, even more disturbing for people who live in the midst of that or who indeed have been targeted because of the colour of their skin or their ethnic origin or their religion. And that is what we have seen in Antrim. I mean, there's a lot of focus, obviously, on the graffiti, the swastika signs, the Combat 18, the National Front graffiti that's happened overnight on Sunday into Monday. But this seems to be part of a sustained campaign of sectarian and racist intimidation across Antrim that goes back to May. One of the families from ethnic minority background who have been intimidated out of Ballycraigie. They reported that they were targeted initially back in May with anti-immigrant posters, and that moved on then to graffiti on their houses, posters being stuck on their windows, big black cross sign being put across their front window, cars parked in the street being smashed. So this is a campaign of intimidation that goes back a month and a half now. It didn't just happen overnight, and it's not just a bit of graffiti. We're talking about the forced displacement of people from their homes by an organised, violent campaign of intimidation.
A campaign of intimidation. And when you talk about a campaign, that just keeps growing and growing. It starts with the odd bit of graffiti, as you say, people who've been intimidated, forced from their homes. There have been so many incidents now. In what is a relatively small area? You wonder what happens next if this is not addressed.
Well, the police obviously need to get a grip on this. I mean, what we've seen in Antrim, I mean, it was concentrated in around the Ballycraigie estate, but this neo-Nazi graffiti has now extended to other locations, including another location where another planned mixed housing development is happening. That is obviously part of the backdrop to this as well. It's not the whole story, but it's part of the backdrop of this pattern of trying to demarcate new housing developments that are supposed to be like mixed housing, as in people with mixed backgrounds, and in some cases it's people with special needs, as we've seen at least in one of these cases in Antrim, that organised criminals, racist thugs, targeting those areas to demarcate them with flags, with graffiti, with curbstone painting, basically to say who is or is not welcome in an area. The sad fact is, through this campaign of intimidation, it is the racists who are winning, because we have seen people intimidated from their homes. We have seen people that they have branded as unwelcome in the community being forced out of that community, places where they were part of the community, including, say, this one African family I'm talking about who lived in Ballycraigie for the last couple of years. So this will continue until the police and the local authorities are able to bring those responsible to account and to send a clear signal that this is not acceptable in Northern Ireland in 2024, because all the signs are is that it is, in that the racists, the people who are using violence and intimidation are the ones who are winning, the people who are ordinary decent families are the ones who are losing, and that in almost all cases, sadly, nobody is being held to account through the criminal justice process in terms of the police catching them and prosecutions. I was at a report launch last week from the policing board, reviewing police performance over the last 5 years, and one of the criticisms in that report was that the prosecution and conviction rate for racist hate crimes in Northern Ireland is half that what it is for any other serious offence. In fact, it's the lowest prosecution success rate of any serious offences in Northern Ireland. So in 9 out of 10 cases, sadly, the people behind these sorts of attacks are getting away with it. And they know that. They know that, and that is why this continues. Antrim and the targeting of people because of their religion or their ethnic origin or the demarcation of new mixed housing developments, that is a long-established pattern across Northern Ireland. It's not isolated to just Ballycraigie or just Antrim. It is something that is rife across this place, and it needs to be brought to an end.
Well, police are investigating. They have said that they are following 5 separate reports made between Sunday and Monday this week of racist graffiti daubed on the sidewalls of properties in the Parkhall Road area, Fountain Hill area, Craigmore Park area, Market Street area and Castle Mall area of Antrim. Inquiries in relation to these reports, which are being investigated as racially motivated hate crimes, are ongoing. They are appealing to anyone with information to get in touch. And it's funny, Patrick, you know, well, it's not funny at all, but when you read out all those areas, it is very much a campaign. This isn't just young people messing around and you know, hanging about a street corner and drawing symbols that they don't fully understand. They know exactly what they're doing here, whoever is doing this.
Yes, they do. And, I mean, you know, it's already been reported by one of our daily newspapers that it's an LVF gang that is behind the attacks in and around Ballycraigie, and we know that the LVF have long had a presence in and around Ballycraigie. So, again, if we look at the patterns elsewhere where we see violent attacks, violent racist attacks, there is a pattern there of people in dark clothing and masked men, gangs of them, carrying out these attacks. So I think that, you know, I think one has to draw a conclusion that it's not some random individual. These are organised, armed, probably, and certainly dangerous paramilitary criminal gangs who are responsible for much of this campaign of racist and sectarian intimidation in Antrim, as we have seen elsewhere. If we think of, you know, we think of attacks elsewhere, for instance, in sort of South Belfast, for instance, again, the BBC Spotlight ran a programme on that last year and documented again how there was loyalist paramilitary involvement there. The repeated arson attacks on the Belfast Multicultural Association in Donegal Pass, which again succeeded in literally burning them out of their community home. Again, it's strongly believed that that was, again, Natius UVF, loyalist paramilitary involvement there. And again, we come back to the fact that it's sadly far too infrequent do we see the people responsible held to account. And so it goes on and it goes on. And I think what we need to see now is, I should say, I noted the police response to these graffiti attacks, but as I have noted, this campaign of racist and sectarian intimidation in Antrim goes back to May. As far as I'm aware, nobody has been held to account. Nobody has been arrested to date for a campaign that has been running for something like 6 weeks and is proving successful in terms of the objectives of the people behind it. So we need a much more effective police response. I think they need to heed the words of the policing board, and there's an expectation there that they do better on this. And I think we need to see political leadership in Antrim, but across Northern Ireland as well, to stand with the people who have been victims of these attacks and to say that this is not acceptable and it's not the sort of Antrim or not the sort of Northern Ireland that we will accept.
Well, I want to speak now to former senior police officer John Burrows. Good morning to you, John. John, you will have heard Patrick Corrigan from Amnesty International speaking there. He says that more effective police response is needed in this situation. We have people texting in saying this has been an ongoing issue and quite simply, nothing really is being done to address it.
Yes, it's hard to listen to that. Look, you know, I have to agree that something has to be done. And I think there's a danger sometimes in the police investigating individual cases of criminal damage, reactively, with different investigating officers responding to a crime, with whoever's on shift, investigating it and going through the motions. But in a case like this, where it's a campaign of intimidation, a linked campaign of intimidation, you need to have one overarching investigation. And it needs to be a proactive, well-resourced, probably detective-led investigation, like you would have for a serious crime. So we need to see these as what they are, is one series of linked crimes that are part of a campaign of intimidation, not just a series of reactive investigations. Mm. So, you know, it's for the police to actually come out and say, we've now decided to set up a task force on this. We've got one overarching senior investigating officer. We've got a resource team pulling it all together. Because what that does is it brings in a pile of resources and a strategic approach, an investigative strategy, as opposed to just, you know, so what's the intelligence picture? Where should we be patrolling? Where do we need to try and make inroads in terms of our getting information?
What proactive tactics
can we use? Because it's very, I often hear, you know, oh, the police are going to increase visibility. That's important for reassurance.
Can I just clarify one thing? Because I honestly don't know. When the police are dealing with something like this, with an incident, are they all treated separately, all different separate cases, and not, as we've discussed earlier with Patrick, the idea that it's a campaign, it's something that's being organised?
Unfortunately, it depends if someone in leadership grips it. And you know, I've been there. It can simply be that someone says, look, oh, this is awful. You have lots of different investigating officers simply responding shift by shift. But it needs sort of direction from someone in leadership to say, stop. This, yes, we're going to have a response each time, but there's going to be an overarching investigative team looking at this and pulling together all the strands, because you may need proactive policing, covert methodology, as well as all of your other things that an investigative strategy brings. So, you know, we need to get some grip on this, and we need to hear answers from the PSNI, but also from politicians. And, you know, I endorse what Patrick said. You should have each MLA and the MP shoulder to shoulder with the police, standing up and saying, whoever's getting information about this, bring it forward to Crime Stoppers, bring it forward to the PSNI. Because if you get a name, you can start making inquiries.
One issue we've not addressed, and it has been mentioned by Patrick and by many people on text this morning, the idea that this is a paramilitary operation, that these are organised gangs that are behind this, and not just masked youths.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly a degree of organisation. It's got an overarching purpose. We've seen a similarity in the method, because we've got this sort of far-right combat 18 Nazi stuff. And by the way, you know, someone who's put on a uniform and served their community and their country and comes from a long history of that, I find it so appalling that people who would call themselves loyalists associate themselves with neo-Nazism, because, you know, people who were truly patriotic to the country put on a uniform and went across to Europe to liberate it from Nazis, and a lot of them paid a price for that. So, you know, there needs to be a real leadership at community level saying the Nazis and fascism has no part of our culture. You know, that's a really important message. And I would just, you know, say again, you know, we need local people, because someone will know who this is. You know, local people will know, to have the courage and confidence to give the information to the police or Crime Stoppers. And we need to get that message, because nobody, you know, Crime Stoppers is an anonymous independent charity. They've never divulged the details of whoever's given information. And if anyone has that information, give it to Crime Stoppers or the PSNI, 0800 555 111 for Crime Stoppers. Because with that information, we can get, the police service can start making inquiries. But, you know, there's undoubtedly an organisation behind this. And, you know, what really gets me is often the person who is caught is someone who is younger, who is impressionable. And the people who will get away with it were the people who are actually sinister and putting them up to it.
John Burrows, thank you for the moment. Getting lots of texts and calls on this, including Brian in Enniskillen, who says this sectarianism, paramilitaries are doing this. He says they have complete control. Police come out with normal statements. He says, get off your backside and do something about this. Where are the Antrim politicians on the radio show? Well, guess what, Brian? We'll be speaking to John Blair, Alliance MLA, straight after your BBC News headlines. It is 9:37. You are listening to the Stephen Nolan Show with Holly Hamilton. We've just been talking about this spate of attacks in Antrim town, where racist graffiti has been sprayed at multiple sites just a week after eight families were intimidated out of their homes in the town. It's been described this morning as a tsunami of racism in Antrim town. Lots of you getting in touch. Ken says this behaviour needs to be nipped in the bud immediately by civic society before it gets a grip across the province. Let's speak to Stephen, who's in Antrim. Good morning to you.
Hi, good morning, Holly. What doesn't surprise me is the lack of comment from the politicians, albeit I acknowledge that John Blair is going to be on shortly. Mm-hmm. But the graffiti itself is still there. Castle Mall in the centre of Antrim, you know, that's owned and operated by a business. That business should have got rid of the graffiti already. Because those that get the youngsters to put it up there know exactly what effect that they're going to achieve. And that's having programmes like yours and the media in general commenting on it. But if you can't see the message, then it disappears in terms of its effectiveness.
Is that literally putting a sticking plaster on it, just painting over the problem and in the hope that it goes away?
Well, whatever you think that you're going to achieve by painting over graffiti, it can no longer be seen. The message is removed. Instead, the aims and objectives are achieved by the media after the messages are put up, giving it the oxygen of publicity. That's what these people want.
You're from Antrim, am I right?
Yes, correct.
And is it something that you get a sense of, that the idea, and does it concern you that there are people who are, you know, putting Nazi symbols up? Particularly, we know the history of that. We know what that means. We know the intimidation that comes with that. And we know that people have actually been so intimidated that they've left their homes in Antrim.
Yeah. But again, this is nothing new, Holly. I lived in Belfast when I was a young man. The effects are essentially to benefit those behind those who are putting the messages up. And they are the people who are enjoying this. No one else is. The businesses aren't. What I'm surprised about the Castle Mall is that they haven't obliterated, removed that message, so that the longer it's up, the more that people will talk about it. Exactly the aim that those behind those that put the graffiti up in the first place want to achieve. And that has to be tied in to the lack of voice from the politicians.
You said yourself, though, Stephen, this is nothing new. It keeps happening. Should we live in a society where something like this can keep happening, and the way to solve it is just paint over it? They're going to keep doing it.
Holly, we have a little subterranean passageway in the Victoria Street in Belfast, near Ann Street. Okay. And it's graffitied in a different way, you see. Yeah. And nobody says diddly squat about it. But when there's a message or an implied message in the graffiti, that, you know, I think those that run the businesses or whose property the graffiti is put on need to take immediate steps to obscure it. You know,
should
you can
it be
have
their responsibility, though?
Well, they're the property owners, and that has to be done along with the support of the council. The council have people who, can get out there and help them to do that, either to provide the materials or, the council can do this themselves. They should be doing it.
It's another way to look at it. Stay there, Stephen. I'm going to speak to John Blair, who is an Alliance MLA, of course, in Antrim. Good morning to you, John.
Good morning, Holly.
John, what do you make of that? What is the response then? Do we just paint over it and hope they go away? Or how do we tackle this?
Well, there are a number of ways to tackle it, but Holly, if you don't mind me taking a moment just to say that what has happened in Antrim in the last few weeks, both the racist and sectarian intimidation, is utterly appalling and is to be condemned unreservedly. This is the 21st century. Swastikas painted on walls in a busy town or adjacent to residential areas is beyond the pale. This is direct attack on people. It is blatant and criminal thuggery, and it must be challenged, and police should be assisted by anyone who can assist them in carrying out criminal investigation in relation to this. Regarding the graffiti specifically, this casts a shadow over Antrim. Of course it does. That the scene is threatened by many people. Residents are impacted, traders, as you've pointed out, are impacted, and visitors to the town are impacted also. There's an immediate reason, of course, to remove this graffiti. Council could have a role there, and council has other agencies such as Good Relations and PCSP, Police Community Safety Partnerships, who should also have a role. I expect the traders will do their best to have this removed. But yes, in response to what Stephen said there, there should be those in council with the proper equipment and paint removal materials to have this removed. And that's one step, but supporting the police in criminally investigating those responsible for intimidation and graffiti is an important measure.
Stephen, are you happy with that then? Do you think, that it's just get the paintbrushes out and that will solve the issue then? Are you happy?
Yes, you know, I've always believed in that concept, you see, that if there are offensive messages portrayed via people's property, that the first and the most immediate step is to do something to obscure it. Because, number one, it wasn't the property owners that put the messages there. But what you have to do is shut off the oxygen of publicity to those who want to instill fear and misunderstanding and threat. And I'm most perturbed, given that we only had a, you know, an election last week, about the silence of the councillors of Antrim as a whole. John's on the airwaves right now, doing it on behalf of the Alliance Party. But the Alliance Party are only one of many parties that could be in concert, all together, condemning this. And never mind the condemnation, because it doesn't count for much in terms of reducing fear. Then you have to balance that with removing the message. And, Holly, I'm not sure whether you're aware, but Castle Mall in Antrim, where some of that graffiti is displayed, is across the car park from the police station in Antrim.
Okay, I didn't know that, to be fair. I really didn't.
Yep. I imagine that the CCTV cameras are going to be turned in a new direction now. But that's not the solution to the problem. I think the short term solution is the one that is likely to reduce the talk about this. It needs to be calmed down and put into perspective and let those police and other agencies do their job.
All right. Stephen, thank you very much for your call this morning. John, so that's, I mean, we've sort of dealt with a short term solution, as Stephen said there. But in terms of what is growing in Antrim, as I said at the very start of the show, what is going on that there are people taking to the streets in masks and painting swastikas on the side of buildings? What is the sense? What is the mood music there?
Well, it's clearly, as I've pointed out already, an attempt to directly threat and intimidate some people living in our community. And this is a time.
Amnesty International says they're winning.
Well, this is a time for people like me and others to step up and say very clearly this. We share our community. None of us own our community. And those who seek ownership, and it's been displayed very clearly here, normally have an ulterior motive, especially when that desire for ownership is expressed through attack or messaging delivered by people in masks during the hours of darkness. But it's also important that I point out that this is not reflective of the wider Antrim community at all. This is comparatively a small number of people making a very major impact. I have been contacted, Holly, I can assure you, by many people from Antrim, many who have moved to Antrim, many who are concerned about Antrim. I've spoken to local traders, I've spoken to local police, and there is a will to do something about this. And many of the people who have contacted me, members of our community, have said, what can I do to help here?
Mm-hmm. Should it come to members of the community, though? Because the key word here is intimidation, and so much so that people have left their homes. How do you stop that? If it's not through criminal means, how politically can you stop that?
Well, politically, we should work with, we speak out, first of all, of course, but we should also work with public agencies to ensure that those affected have support in the first instance and do what we can to help people feel safe or safer, but also work to ensure that those intent on carrying out criminality of any kind, for that matter, are challenged and are challenged in a structured way. And in relation to the speaking out issue, Holly, I think it's important to point out, and I'm sure you'll agree with this, that you'll be aware that during election time, there are restrictions around those of us who are election candidates about public reporting, media reporting, and also meeting with public bodies. Now, meetings can take place, but they can't be done publicly. And I want to make clear, I have been dealing directly and indirectly with local residents and local council colleagues, as well as representatives from the church, for example, from some of those impacted by the racist attacks. I've met with housing agencies. I met with local police 2 Fridays ago and asked for assurances that criminal investigations were underway, and I was told that they were. So an important component here is that the public, anyone with any information at all about what has gone on here, is able to forward that information to police so those responsible can be brought to justice.
John Blair, thank you very much for your time on this morning. We will have to leave it there. There are so many texts on this too, responding to what's been said this morning, including Sammy in Belfast, who says painting over the intimidation is not a solution. The local MLAs of the policing board to say that is ridiculous. I want to challenge them. We need education on jobs and education, and not immigrants are not the threat. Thank you for your response on that. 03030 80 55 55. It is 9:10. And for the week that's in it, we weren't going to get through this week without talking about bonfires, were we? Yes, there's a bonfire in Belfast that's caused a bit of controversy after pallets and other material have been gathered and dumped at the Dr. John Pitt Memorial Park on the Newtonards Road in East Belfast. So this park, if you're not aware, it's only just opened after a £1.7 million revamp. It's got a new playground, it's got a multi-use games area, it's got natural stone paths. It's all sparkling brand new. £1.7 million of your money. Money funded by the Executive Office's Urban Villages Initiative and the Department for Infrastructure. Now, Belfast City Council are in charge. They were responsible in delivering this scheme. They've told the programme that a member-led decision-making process has been agreed to consider issues and make decisions on a site-by-site basis. So I'm interested to know what that decision-making process is, site-by-site basis. We've gone back to them this morning to ask this and what decision they've made following that. Now, on Thursday night, of course, this bonfire will be lit on the grounds beside the park. The story was first reported by the Irish News yesterday. Let's speak now to community worker in East Belfast, Muir Holmes. Good morning to you, Muir.
Good morning, Holly.
Morning. Also on the line, we have commentator and former Sinn Féin election candidate, Chris Donnelly. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Holly.
So first of all, Muir, in East Belfast, I mean, it's not really a surprise that there's going to be a bonfire in this area. But I suppose that the two ideas of a brand new sparkling park and setting fire to a huge, huge thing, I mean, there are concerns that it will be damaged. That's quite simply the crux of the story.
Yeah, well, there are concerns. And to my knowledge, there is a bonfire committee that manages that bonfire within Pitt Park. And over the past number of weeks, they have been engaging with the bodies that be to try and work out some positive interventions and solutions around that bonfire site. That park is a fantastic park. It is welcomed and supported by the entire community. And so is the bonfire. And at this point in time, the bonfire positive interventions have ensured that the bonfire does not pose a serious risk to the adjacent property to the new park. There's been positive interventions in the form of sand being put down underneath the bonfire. There's been fire retardant material applied to some of the lampposts adjacent to it, and the bonfire builders themselves have committed to ensuring that the bonfire height does not increase, and it's not going to be the same height as it was in previous years. So there's been lots of positive steps to ensure that the property is protected. Nobody wants a bonfire culture that damages property. Nobody wants a bonfire culture that damages parks, and positive steps are about ensuring that that takes place or doesn't take place.
Chris Donnelly, does that reassure you?
It's absurd. It's positively through the looking glass stuff, Holly. Firstly, whether or not there's a bonfire committee, there's absolutely no legal status to the bonfire committee. This, at the end of the day, is a fire, which is a very dangerous thing. We know in the last couple of years, a man has died after falling from a bonfire in Lorne. We know the year before that, the young man suffered life-changing injuries at a bonfire in in the Ballisillan area of North Belfast. Listen, this happens every year. It's deja vu all over again. And it needs to be said, there's nothing wrong per se or illegitimate about people wishing to continue with a bonfire tradition. in this part of Ireland. Lord knows we know how important cultural traditions are to many people. That ain't going to change. But what this has to be about is finding a way to regulate that tradition so that health and safety standards are adhered to. And obvious concerns are allayed in the same manner that they are in every other facet of life. Now, you've just pointed out, Holly, it's £1.7 million of public money went into this. You'd like to think that those actual legal bodies who are responsible for health and safety in this part of the world would actually be involved in protecting what is a public resource to make sure that it is not damaged. Not far away in Tullycarnock.
That's exactly what's happening at the moment.
No, it's not. It's not what is
If you want to put a fire anywhere else, go ahead, Mur.
I do want to hear what Mur has to say here on this, actually. Go ahead, sorry.
Just relax. You've read a story in the Irish news. You've read a headline, and then now we're coming in to do what we always do at this time of year, which is to lay the boot into the loyalist community and the bonfire tradition.
Nobody's laying the boot anywhere.
You and many people will have to accept that the bonfire culture is precisely that, Chris. It is culture, and cultural rights are human rights. Loyalists, just like every other citizen within society, has the right to participate in the cultural life of the community. And the bonfire tradition in this part of the world is a fantastic one. It is a celebrated one. And through positive engagement, positive dialogue, community leadership, we are seeing less and less controversial incidences like the ones that we're talking about now, and more positive expressions of culture being had. There has been great engagement around this park site. PSNI officers, you'll not know this because you've only read the headline, but I've actually spoke to the people on the ground and engaged with the community about it. PSNI officers went to the site and said that it doesn't pose a threat, given the interventions that have taken place. It doesn't pose a threat to some of the property nearby. So much of this is very much sensationalised by the media. Yes, we have this bad optics of a new park with an old bonfire, but there's lots of interventions that have been put in place through good leadership, through positive dialogue, to minimise the risks attached with it. And that's really
the
future
for bonfires.
Mur, you mentioned the word I was going to mention there, actually, and it is the optics of it, because we spend so much time on this programme talking about money. So when you hear that there's £1.7 million has gone, and it is a lovely park, by the way, it really is very, very nice, they've done a lovely job. When you hear that money's been spent, and then, you know, the idea that there's this big bonfire going to be next year, there have been things that have been put in place to prevent any damage.
I absolutely accept that, and I think, you know, whilst I am very quick to talk about the rights of people within the loyalist community to enjoy their culture, to celebrate their culture, rights that some other people I think would be happy to deny when it comes to the cultural heritage of expressing identity through bonfires. We also have to talk about the responsibilities. We have responsibilities to ensure that bonfires are safe and that bonfires are sustainable, and that bonfires as a culture, it's not just about preserving it, but it's about enhancing it. And that's why I think some of the work that has happened in Pitt Park is positive. People in Pitt Park care about the park there. They care about the facilities there. They're well in need, and they're well deserved.
Can I put that to Chris, actually, then?
Positive steps,
Chris,
to protect that.
This is a park in a local area. This is what people in this area who are living in this area, that's what they want. That's what they want the park for.
People want the park for children to be able to play in a park.
It's not going into the play park, to be fair.
People don't want People don't want a £1.7 million facility to be damaged. The difficulty in all this is, and really it should not be controversial to point out, the absurdity of family homes and libraries, including the nearby library in Tullycarnock, having to be boarded up so that large fires can be lit in the middle of residential communities next to facilities like libraries or parks. That is not about protecting culture. A bonfire can be put, like any other, you light a fire anywhere else in the society, you're going to have health and safety and environmental officers rightly on top of you to make sure that things are done in the right way. All of that is put out the window when it comes to this time of year, every year, and we know the damage that happens. We have a man that died in Lorne at a bonfire that wasn't properly regulated. So rather than dancing around this about culture, there's no difficulty with accepting that there is a tradition within our society of bonfires. But it's like the issue of parades. Once regulation is introduced, it'll bring it within the realms of acceptable behavior so that society can move forward, so that loyalism can continue to have bonfires as part of the culture. But, you know, when you look and see family homes boarded up, how is that putting human rights? How is that saying Chris, that the bonfire is protecting Chris, the human rights?
Very quickly.
There are over 300 bonfires in Northern Ireland. There's a handful of controversies. By imposing regulation and laws on the totality of bonfires in Northern Ireland would be akin to using a sledgehammer to crack a walnut. That's not what's needed. What we need is community leadership, and that's what we're getting, community leadership. And listen, everyone cares about the protection of property.
All right.
I mean, we are out of time on this, chaps,
I'm afraid. Chris Donnelly, thank you very much to you and to Muir Homes for your time. BBC News is next. We'll have more after 10 o'clock. 030 30 80 55 55.
Make the news. Be the news. This is The Nolan Show.
Thank you so much for all your calls and texts so far this morning. Keep them coming. 030 30 80 55 55. We were talking about bonfires just before the news there. Specifically one in East Belfast, which has been erected next to a brand new park, newly refurbished park, I should say, at a cost of £1.7 million. And I did say that the bonfire is not in the children's play park. Mary's got in touch and says it is. It is in the play park. There are two new big structures put in there for children to play in. It's surrounded by houses on three sides, only protected by a small path. Now, I'll have to go and look again. I don't think, like I say, it's in the swing set, but it apparently is quite close to the park. Again, get in touch on any of our stories today and let us know what you think. Much appreciated. And in a moment, I definitely want you to get in touch on this because it is about you. We were talking yesterday about who voted. And I referred to this, the fact that it was the lowest turnout here in Northern Ireland, in history, am I right in saying? Obviously, all the MPs are off to Westminster to start their new day at school, voted for by you. But yeah, just over 57% of people who can vote in Northern Ireland actually voted. Only two constituencies reached over 60%. That was Fermanagh, South Tyrone and Mid Ulster. So was the low turnout due maybe to the time of year? Some of you might have been on holiday. Or is it actually more to do with people just being disinterested in politics, not caring? Well, I've been speaking to editor of Slugger O'Toole, Mick Fealty, and the writer and Belfast Telegraph columnist, Malachy O'Doherty. And I began by asking Mick if he actually was surprised by the turnout.
No, not really. There's been a trend towards low turnout. And actually, it's not very uniform. I went back and had a look at the first election results after the Good Friday Agreement was signed. That was 2001. And back then, it was 69% overall as opposed to 57%. That's a drop of about 12%, but it's not very even. In North Down, where I come from originally, it didn't drop at all in that period of time. Mm-hmm. Where we've seen the really big drops is in places that are still relatively high to, compared to other places, like West Tyrone and Mid-Ulster. Back in 2001, West Tyrone had 81%. It's dropped 22% since then, back down to 59%. And I think what that represents is that west of the ban, there's no longer any serious competition for the seats. Sinn Féin is in pole position almost every time. And with the best will in the world, if you know or you feel or you think it's going to be a foregone conclusion, then turnout will drop. It tends not to drop in the east because, as we've seen, the east of Northern Ireland is incredibly competitive. Not simply within unionism, as we saw in North Antrim, where Jim Allister took the seat off Ian Paisley, but in other places like Lagan Valley, where Alliance took a seat, where an independent unionist took a seat in North Down off Alliance. And it's that competitiveness, I think, that has kept, if you like, turnout pretty steady. I mean, there are drops. I mean, North Belfast is an interesting one.
Yeah.
It dropped by about 12%. over that long period of time. But the 12, that's, that all happened between the last really competitive election and this one, John Finucane ousted Nigel Dodds. And today, where it felt like a bit of a foregone conclusion.
So that's interesting, because when we get results like this, when the turnout is so low, we try to reason it away. We try to think, what's the time of year? It's to do with this, that and the other. And actually, Malachy, when you look at the results, when you do get particular drops within certain areas, that's not to suggest then that people in the west of the ban have all gone on holiday and in the east have stayed at home. It's maybe to do with the fact, well, I don't think my guy's going to win anyway, so I'm not going to bother going out to vote.
Well, that's part of it. I mean, one way of looking at this almost as well is as an urban-rural divide, where you're getting the big drops in Belfast and less so in the rural areas. Big drop in Foyle as well. So what we might call our metropolitan areas, you know, get the lower turnout, perhaps because hot people do go on holiday at that time. That's another part of it. There's also a mismatch between what the media thought was exciting and what the public thought was exciting.
Yes.
So, I mean, the media was right in saying that Lagan Valley was an interesting contest and you got the high turnout there. But, the media was wrong in saying, you know, that East Belfast was going to be an utterly engaging contest, because you got a drop there. You didn't get the big Naomi Gaffin rematch, you know, being the big draw that the media thought it would be. So perhaps, one factor in this is that the public is less interested in politics than we are, and I think that's a reality. And another factor that I think we always leave out of account, and it is a shocking factor, is the level of illiteracy in Northern Ireland. We've got about 17% illiteracy in Northern Ireland. That suggests people who are not reading newspapers, they're not maybe paying much attention to the news, they've zoned out, or they're not equipped to engage in the bigger arguments and discussions in society. Well, so that's part of it too.
I don't even think perhaps it's to do with being illiterate, and like you say, because you can't tune into the radio, everything's there, even on social media, it's hard to avoid. I feel like we perhaps have got to a point, and I do find it when we step outside our echo chamber a little bit here, you're right, we get wrapped up in the media, and I reckon people listening to this show probably right now, you probably did vote because you're listening to this and you do care, so it's not aimed at you, it's when you step away from that, and I could ask somebody on the street, who is the First Minister? Who is the Prime Minister? And more often than not, and more often than we like to think, people struggle to give us an answer. We're quite naive to that in our little bubble here. We really are. Yeah. But then the question then is, how do we get through to those people? Because they should care, of course. But with all of everything that's happened, they don't. So what's gone wrong?
Well, part of the problem is that in Northern Ireland, it's a divided society debate, and a lot of people are, disengaging from that. I mean, one symptom of that disengagement from the divided society argument is a shift towards alliance, but you're seeing a decline there as well now. So it's maybe there is a kind of damned a lot of you, a curse in all your houses attitude. But there's also across the whole UK a kind of fatigue with politics. Perhaps because it has become so tedious. I think if you have in Northern Ireland periods of up to 3 years when the assembly falls, you're almost suggesting to people that politics don't matter. When a political party says it's not going to take its seats, you're actually giving a message that politics doesn't really matter. So I think, you might see around the Labour revival something like you got in 97, of a greater enthusiasm for politics unfolding if people are persuaded that it is working. But I don't think it's entirely surprising that people are just cheesed off of the whole thing here, given how static and dull it's been.
Do you think like that's part of it? Is it just people are bored?
No, I don't think so. And I don't agree with Malachy on that. I think, look, the truth is, the biggest drop in turnout is not in the urban areas, where it has remained fairly steady, with the single exception of Foyle. And that suggests to me that in Foyle, a lot of people who normally don't vote came out to vote and put Colm Eastwood in. It partly explains why he got that 17,000 majority. something like 12 or 13% drop in turnout suggests that those people went, right, we've sent our message, we didn't want that Sinn Féin MP, we're not going to continue to support Eastwood, but we have done our job. And what's happened in Foyle is that the SDLP has returned to the kind of majority that it traditionally had under John Hume.
And, I was still an 11% drop, Mick.
Sorry?
I mean, I'm, the figures I'm looking at, if they're right, there was 11% drop in turnout in Foyle.
That's right, yeah. But, yeah. No, but what I'm saying is those people, I think that represents people who came out, who normally don't vote, who came out to send a message in 2019, and they've just basically gone back to what they did before, which is not bothering with voting. But that's very specific. As I say, in North Down, over the 23-year period from 2001, there's been no change in turnout. There's no change. And yet that was a very competitive election where Alliance lost out. For very particular reasons, I think we mustn't denigrate the voters because they act in ways we didn't anticipate. And I'm sure Malachy's like me. I certainly didn't anticipate North Antrim going, East Londonderry nearly going to Sinn Féin, East Antrim, Sammy Wilson, who clearly thought he was safe as houses. Well, you know what? He's been sent notice, if not to quit, that if he doesn't buck his act up, he may well face eviction the next time round.
And it probably, shouldn't take that really though, should it? And do you think the individual campaigns, and when we look and analyse at the likes of the TUV, which was a very vocal campaign, and there we saw the result obviously with Ian Paisley losing his seat to Jim Allister.
Yeah.
Was there a little bit of a, you know, with particular within certain parties and within certain candidates who maybe just didn't do enough? They weren't knocking on enough doors. And I know I spoke to a lot of people who they didn't get a knock on the door. They didn't even get a leaflet from some people.
I think there's a clear difference in culture. I mean, look, the Sinn Féin representative who was elected in Newry and Armagh lives in South Down. He's never been elected before. He was appointed as mayor of the old Newry and Mourne district council, now defunct. But that's because he was co-opted by the party machine. And he was easily elected without having to do anything really in terms of making an impact. That is a territory which is no longer competitive. It's effectively a Sinn Féin suzerainty, and there's no competition there. The SDLP did okay, but certainly not threatening that hegemony in that particular area. North Down, totally different, totally competitive. I mean, all three Antrim constituencies, very competitive. There is no hiding place in eastern Northern Ireland because it is a competitive, chaotic, and difficult to win in territory. And that's actually very good for democracy.
Yeah.
It means actually, whatever the percentage of people voting, they know that their vote can actually make a difference. And those politicians, especially DUP politicians, who've been comfortably sitting above the fray and above the voters in many ways, have been told, really, you can't behave whatever way you like, you can't do whatever you like, we're watching and we will take retribution if we don't like what we're getting.
Yeah, and that's interesting. And I think, Malachy, that's what we're seeing across the board. We're seeing it right across the UK, where actually the turnout was the lowest it's ever been. And I think it maybe didn't have as much to do with apathy as people just, all the press and the media has told me who's going to win, so my vote won't make any difference.
Well, the interesting question for me, we had about 500,000 people entitled to vote who didn't bother.
Yeah.
Now, okay, there'll be excuses for some of them. They were away on holiday or whatever. There's particularly bad timing for Northern Ireland because the schools are out already. A question for me would be whether that 40% that tend not to vote, you know, and I mean, it is nearly that even in good years. It's the same 40% all the time.
Yeah.
And why so many people are disengaged from politics in an area where politics seems to be the passionate concern of the media and certainly the political parties, where politics is so heated, you know, why is it that, you know, something like, well, a third to a quarter of the population are not remotely interested, you know, than a third.
That's really interesting. It's something we talk about an awful lot, but even comparing whenever I do programs across the border compared to here, people care a lot here. They really care. Yeah. And when you do speak to people about the issues, I said earlier on, if you talk to people about who people, individuals are, they might not know, but they know what they care about. So it is surprising to find out they don't vote.
But the 40% that doesn't care, do they care about something else? Is there some political idea that hasn't been brought to the fore that would grab their attention? When you get to...
What I would say is that this is, in a way, just a return to the general meme in other democracies. It's, you know, Australia, where voting is compulsory, is a place where you can get up to the 80, 90, even 100% on occasions.
Would you like to see that introduced here?
Well, I mean, it's an idea. I don't think it'll be terribly popular because I think there'll be a lot of cultural resistance to it. But what I'm saying is there's nothing particularly special about sub 60% turnouts. We've seen it in the Republic. We see it in GB. It's pretty commonplace. What was uncommon was the 82, 84% turnouts that we saw in the very early stages of the peace process.
I think or in the referenda. You get that in referendums.
Yeah, because a lot of people come out and go, right, I know what that's about, and I'm going to make sure that I'm listened to.
But, and you'll get that in a border poll. You'll get that in a border poll. Yeah. You'll get your 85, 90% turnout in a border poll, which tells you that the political parties who are claiming that their scale of representation is indicative of how a border poll might go are completely wrong.
Absolutely.
Talking about, it's a really interesting conversation. I could talk about this all day and trying to get into the ins and outs of why people do and do not vote. Only they know the answer. 030 30 80 55 55. Malachy O'Doherty, Mick Fielty, thank you very much as always for your time on this. And a lot of you have been getting in touch to have your say on this. Gareth got in touch. He says he went into the polling stations to just to see the figures and how many people were turning up. He noticed a lack of younger voters, certainly in his area. He says the process of putting paper into a box is becoming alien to voters in modern societies. Social media is easier to use and you would have more voters. They are irrelevant and it's not normal for them. And can you blame them? James says, I think it's time voting was made compulsory. And why not hold the voting on a Sunday rather than disrupt everything during the week? And Heather says, I did vote, but there were none of the candidates who came round our area. Maybe that's why people did not vote. And Wayne says, well, he feels that if people turn out, things are never fixed anyway. Thank you very much for all your comments on that. For those who did vote, well, the people that you voted for are over at Westminster today to start their new jobs. Many of them you might have seen across social media sharing selfies of their train journeys. Some of them complaining about delays and cancellations today. Some things never change. But today, the House of Commons will reconvene, which means the Speaker will be elected and all MPs, old and new, will be sworn in. Well, joining me this morning is George Parker, who is the Financial Times political editor. Good morning to you, George. George, have we got you? You're not on a delayed train or anything, are you?
No, I'm not. Can you hear me? Okay?
I can hear you loud and clear now. We've talked a bit this morning about this idea. It's almost like Freshers' Week, first day of school. And actually, there are a lot of similarities in terms of you've got to get your new locker, you've got to get orientation, you know, you get a little guide. Tell me what it's like this day.
Well, it is exactly like you say. They're like the first day at school. I've just come out of the central atrium of the House of Commons. The Speaker's there walking around. I just said hello to him. He's wearing a nice burgundy jumper at the moment. I think he'll be changing into his full regalia a bit later on this afternoon. And as you say, you've got loads of MPs turning up. Over half of the MPs sitting in the House of Commons are newly elected. They don't know where they are. They don't know where they're going. They don't know where their office is. As you say, some of them have been delayed on trains coming in. But there's a real buzz of expectation and excitement around, which I haven't seen for some time, actually. It's really refreshing.
Interesting. I can't even remember who the new Transport Minister is at the minute. And a bit like you, it's a lot of work for you, actually, at this point, because you've spent sort of the last, say, 14 years getting to know the people who've been familiar faces, it's fair to say, around the Commons. And now I understand you do get a little guidebook to help you out.
Yeah, you do. There's a little guidebook with the pictures of all the new MPs. That's partly for journalists, but mainly for security officials and doormen and stuff to let people around the premises here. And it's quite a confusing building. It's this vast Gothic Victorian Gothic palace, as you know, with lots of corridors and sort of staircases. You don't know where they're leading to. Yesterday, I was actually showing some MPs out of the building, and one of them got stuck in the security door for about 5 minutes. Wasn't quite sure how to operate that. And I said, there are a lot of people who've lost their seats, some of whom I met last night at a birthday party given by Tom Tugendhat, who's one of the Tory MPs who's hoping to be the next Tory leader. And there are lots of unemployed Tory MPs who just turned up, and it was rather a sad spectacle, to be honest. It is a brutal business.
It is. Funny, we're going to be chatting about that in just a minute with former MP Lembit Opec. But for those who are starting today, and there are a lot of them, there's a lot of brand new MPs today. We've got some of our very own, of course, like Robin Swan and Jim Allister in there today. And there are a lot of rules too. It's a very different way of life when you enter this building. There are things like, you know, the certain areas you don't put your hands in your pockets. You've got to learn the etiquette, and it'll be a huge learning curve, I imagine, for some of these people.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very bizarre workplace, for sure. There are sort of, everyone is their own sort of individual HR department to a large extent. They've got to hire a load of staff and a load of officials. And in the chamber, as you say, there's this weird etiquette where if you want to ask a question, you've got to stand up and then sit down. There are certain ways you have to address ministers, and you know, you're not allowed to call people by their individual surnames. You have to call them by their constituencies. That's pretty confusing. That'd be especially confusing for the Speaker of the House of Commons, of course, because you'll have to remember the names of constituencies of 300 odd new MPs. So it's a difficult day for everyone, really. But you know, there will be a real moment of excitement in the House of Commons chamber later this afternoon when you see all those new Labour MPs turning up, crowding onto the government benches, 400 of them. You know, the House of Commons chamber isn't big enough to accommodate all of the people. They're going to be sitting on each other's knees on the floor, standing at the back. It'll be quite a spectacle.
Yeah, it's just worth watching for that alone, trying to see how they squeeze them all into the place. But it's an important day too. That's hugely significant. Sort of the work starts here, really.
Yeah, and you've got a real sense of that with the new Labour government coming in, trying to hit the ground running, trying to convey a sense of real action. You had Rachel Reeves yesterday setting out a plan to liberalise planning, to say that, you know, the work starts immediately. We want to make Britain the fastest growing economy in the G7. You've got Keir Starmer, of course, later on today, heading off to Washington for a NATO summit, where he's going to be meeting Joe Biden. You've got Wes Streeting, the health secretary, meeting with junior doctors today. So there's been a real sense of sort of motion. And I think that's what the public expects. You know, when they voted for change, they actually wanted to see some evidence of that. And I think they want to see some tangible progress pretty quickly.
Well, George, you have a very busy day ahead. I know that. Thank you very much for taking some time out to chat to us. That's George Parker, the Financial Times political editor. And as I mentioned, let's speak now to former MP Lembit Opec. Good morning to you.
Good morning to you.
Does it bring it all back?
It does. Melancholy and excitement. I remember my first day, and it really was like going to school. I didn't go to a boarding school. I went to Inst. But it's like going to a boarding school, hugely institutionalised, old building, and you don't have a clue what you're doing. And you feel like you're about 15 years old and you pretend to be a grown-up, but it's scary. And I really relate to the description you've just had of the first days there.
Yeah, and it's funny, a lot of people referring to the idea of imposter syndrome, you know, my goodness, what am I doing here? And George mentioned it there. The other side of things, of course, it's those people who lost their seat. This has been their life. This has been their job for so long for some of them. And today will be quite a sad day, I suppose. Not something you've experienced.
It is something I experienced. I didn't intend to lose. And it's from hero to zero in a 5-minute speech on a stage. And it's brutal, I can tell you. The next thing that happens after you lose is you start getting massive harassment from the authorities saying, get out of your room. Oh, you've got to get everything out. And they're totally insistent. It's like debt collectors or something. And they're polite, but incredibly firm. And you have about 5 days to empty everything. And then you're out there in Civvy Street. And for people who've done this for 10, 20, 30 years, especially the older ones, it's really disorientating because you don't know what you're going to do next. Possibly nothing.
And I imagine there are people who might have expected to lose their seat, that they might have sort of prepared themselves and saw this coming. But there are those who didn't. We have, you know, Ian Paisley in North Antrim here, for example, that he said himself it's not the script that he had written for himself. And that must be the shock of that, too.
Yeah, it is. There's an assumption that MPs who lose just go into new jobs. That wasn't the case for me. I struggled, and I became insolvent after 2 years. It was horrendous. I had the bank coming round in threes, talking about repossessing my home. Yeah. And it took me actually a full 3 years, really, to start settling things down. It's never really been quite the same. I never really completely recovered from it. And to be honest with you, I still have a recurring dream. And it's always the same. I'm in Parliament. I'm speaking. I think, oh, this is for real now. I really am back in Parliament. So there's some kind of a trauma which exists within me. And there's a humiliation to it. Whether you are a Democrat or not, standing on a stage, seeing someone else being given your job, it's very public. It's a very public kind of firing, and that hurts.
Yeah, you can see it in their faces. I mean, what is the face you're supposed to have when that happens to you so publicly and very often in the small hours of the morning when you have had absolutely no sleep? It almost sounds to me, it's like a trauma that you have to go over. We're laughing, but it does. It does sound awful.
It's exactly that, and it's worse than that because by definition, a majority of people didn't vote for you. So if you happen to live in your constituency, as I did, people will ridicule you and they'll make fun of you and say, I'm so glad you lost. It's not like just losing a job in an office. It's public and people will be so cruel. Regardless of party, I really feel for them. Craig Williams, who lost his seat in my old seat, I felt for him because I know what it was like to stand on that platform. And the other thing people need to understand, everyone thinks it's a gravy train. You're going from 90 grand a year to nothing. Yeah. And if you didn't plan to lose, you really don't have an onward plan. And you get a certain amount of payout, which is good, but it doesn't last long. And there'll be people who end up in serious straits, and some of them will have psychological problems. My biggest anger is people don't take politicians' feelings seriously. Most politicians do it for the right reasons.
Yes, when they lose, it hurts. Yes or no, Lambert, do you regret it?
I don't regret for a minute being there. I wish I'd been there for 5 years longer.
You'll do it all over again. Lambert Opick, great to chat to you. Thank you so much. Thanks to all of our guests today. We'll be back tomorrow once again from 9 o'clock. Connor Phillips is next. In the country.
Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet at Stephen Nolan. Stephen Nolan Show.